Welcome everyone to today's compiler construction. Last time we were talking about a concept for turning sequences of tokens into a parse tree, and the idea was to do that with an item pushdown automaton, and specifically we were facing the problem that at certain points in the item pushdown automaton we would run into problems of non-determinism, where we wherever we encounter variations of right-hand sides for an expansion, we needed guidance for which variant to actually use for expansion. So the idea that we pursue with LLK parsing is to consider a finite look-ahead window into the input, and based on the first terminals that we can observe in the input, we would try to decide which variant we would take for expansion. So for that purpose, it was necessary to come up with the idea of these first sets. These first sets are sets that are associated with sequences of symbols, or even particular single symbols, and we were after we were looking for a way to compute these first sets for especially non-terminals, as they are part of right-hand sides of grammar roots. So, because that was a little bit sluggish and very fast last time, I'm trying to do that once again a little bit more in detail. So, the idea was that we need some way to distinguish between choosing between variants of production. So, either to choose the first alternative or the second alternative here, which would be E plus T or T. In order to do so, we need to know about which look-ahead symbols would indicate to go for the first alternative and which look-ahead symbols would indicate to go for the second alternative. So, for that, the look-ahead window into the input is a pretty simple thing that is done by the parser implementation itself. The problem is now, how can we say which terminal symbol should indicate for one thing and which should for the other thing? For that, we need to look into the complete sequence of symbols of one of these right-hand sides and go through from left to right and have a look at what these symbols actually either are themselves, if they are already terminals, and if they are not, we have to take into account to what this non-terminal can actually be expanded to. So we introduce for the terminals, it's pretty easy. It's just the terminals themselves that are kind of expected in the look ahead for those. For non-terminals, we try to collect a particular set of terminal symbols that are indicators for this path in our decision tree. So we need to set up these sets for each of the non-terminals that collects these symbols, and that is what we are after here. Just ignore for a short moment that there's this empty sequence also involved. Let's just imagine that we are just associating sets of terminals with each of these non-terminal identifiers. So that's what we see over there. Oh, no. This is one set of first symbols that is associated with S prime. This is one set of first symbols that is associated with T. This is a set of first symbols associated with E. And in order to compute them, we use the fact that we know how the, for example, the non-terminal E will actually expand. We have the right-hand sides here already. And, well, let's look at, for example, this combination here. In this combination here, we know that if I'm interested in the look-ahead set for E, I have to also consider the look-ahead set for T, because that is at the very left of one particular right-hand side for E. Same is the case over here. We for E, we are interested in, well, in this case it would be a recursive definition, so we would be interested in the actual content of the set itself. That is a trivial contribution to how we have to compute the set for E. So all in all, we collect all, the information that we get by these by these productions in sets of well, superset relations. How is it the case that we have superset relations here? Well, you have to consider that, for example, in this case here, E might, for example, at some point produce only a yield of the empty sequence. That is a thing that I wanted you to ignore before. Now it's relevant. If it is the case that E could completely have no yield at all, just the empty thing, we have to also take into account the flowing yield. And if that is also, for example, a non-terminal, we have to take all the first sets of that non-terminal into account. If that also is able to produce the empty sequence, we have to go one step further, and so on. If at some point we know for sure that we cannot produce the empty sequence from that symbol, we can terminate with looking at the next symbol of a right-hand side. Particularly if we hit such a terminal symbol itself, we know for sure that this thing won't produce the empty sequence. So at that point, we can stop collecting the first symbols and terminate our computation. So on all this results in unions of first sets of right-hand side symbols. Thus, the superset relation between the sets of these things. So in our special example here, we never have an empty sequence of symbols on any right-hand side. In that case, that's a special case, we know that none of the non-terminals will ever be able to produce the empty sequence. And in these cases, we never have to go these steps and do the union of several first sets. But in the general case, whenever there is the chance that there is a right-hand side that has epsilon over there, in that case, for example, T might be considered to be able to yield the empty sequence at some point. And for example, in order to determine the first set of this thing here, we now would need to consider the first set of T as well as the first set of the star terminal, and that is just itself. So anyway, with that, we get this system of superset relations. This thing over here. Is that clear so far? You don't know. So it's a chance to
what's the S
prime thing? Yeah, well, at some points I'm maybe a little bit inconsequent here. That is kind of an artificial production that I add for everything in order to have a unique symbol over here that gives us end of file that makes that terminates the whole thing. Yeah, got me. So in principle, I would have to add that to the whole thing. So I didn't do that here, but in principle, yeah, since E is my start symbol, I should introduce something like that. E and end of file symbol. Yeah, usually this S prime is actually always this artificial non-terminal throughout the rest of the slides also. So that is kind of a convention. Yeah. If you're unsure what that means, just ignore this thing and have a look at the rest. Okay. So then there was this idea of how to compute these things very efficiently. I don't know whether there's still a question from last time. No? So I assume you all know how to do that. There will be a tutorial exercise for that anyway, but in case there's questions, it's better to ask them the complete audience, I would say. No? Okay, good. So you have to set up this graph and then compute the strongly connected components, do a union of all the contributions on that, and then go through the graph that you obtain from the strongly connected components and just let the contributions flow through that graph and yeah, be done with your determination of the sets. So with that you can come up with these first epsilon free first sets. So the thing with which we have ended last time was the original problem which we wanted to solve, which was this transition relations of the item pushdown automaton. We said that there would be problems in certain transaction pairs, for example this one in 0 and 1 and also in 3 and 4, because well, you could choose either expansion for S in that case and you just would not know why. So now the idea would be for an LL1 parser to set up a table that guides you in which alternative to actually choose. So that is a table that has columns that are labeled with look-ahead symbols, and it has lines that are labeled with non-terminals to expand. So in case you, or not you, but the LL1 parser needs to decide for a non-terminal how to expand, it can go to that table, look for the appropriate line, and then check the input for whatever look ahead symbol it finds there, for example this one, and with that it could then read off in here the number of the alternative to choose. So that is the kind of goal that we want to establish here. The question is now, how can we do that based on our newly established property of first symbols. The thing is, concretely in our example, we would need to come up with entries for that table for the case that you see kind of sketched over here. So we would need to disambiguate between the cases where we would expand the S with AS. Okay. That should have been an S. Sorry about that. Where you would expand the S with ASB. Or this case over here where you would have expanded the S with, well, essentially nothing. And you would have to disambiguate between those two based on the first, well, the first K symbols over here, which in our case would be just the first one symbol that you see in the yield over here. So what do you have to take that first symbol from? Well, in the case of the left variant, you would have to look at the first symbols from that sequence. That is pretty clear. In general, you would if there would be another variant over here with another right-hand side over here, you would just disambiguate between them based on their respective first sets that you can compute now with the help of these first sets for non-terminals and terminals that we had in the slides before. You would just read off what their look-ahead sets would be and would enter the number of the variant based on the symbols that you find in these look-ahead sets for these right-hand sides. But now you see, in our case, we have hit a little bit of a problematic case because, well, this thing here doesn't yield any terminal symbol over here. It's just the empty sequence of symbols over here because, well, it even says here that S can, or S doesn't necessarily produce anything. In that question, in that case, we might ask the question, what is the look ahead for this thing? Because, you see, it's not that the look ahead will then also be empty, but instead you will find something in the look ahead, but that is not determined by the right hand side of the production, but merely by the complete right context of the derivation tree. So, in order to overcome that, we still need to think a little bit more. Especially, we need to take into account what the first sets of all the things that come after the momentarily focused subtree can be. And turns out that you need to take into account not only the first sets of a right-hand side, but also the first sets of all the yields of all the contexts in which this thing actually appears. So we would need to consider not the first set of only the right-hand side of a production, but the first set of the right-hand side, one concatenated with the first set of its primary contexts, then its secondary context, so on until we reach the general context for that thing, which would always be a kind of a subtree that is spawned from there. That is something that we give a special name. We call that the follow set. And it's the follow set of not the gamma thing, but the B, because the B is actually the thing that determines the context for the thing, because that might occur somewhere in another production right-hand side, and thus that's the place where we have to look for if we are interested in all the things that can come after the input. So to make things short, we can formulate a kind of a similar thing as we have done for the first sets, also for the follow sets, which is then called the follow one set for a non-terminal. And this consists in the one concatenation of all the first sets of of the symbols that can that form up the context for that non-terminal, and in a valid derivation tree will appear right off the of the spot where our expansion in question has appeared. We can compute that by once again setting up such a system of superset relations, this time for follow one sets. There is one for which we know that inconsistencies everywhere. That is the special thing that I was talking about before. I think you wanted to know that, this S prime thing. That is always considered to be the root node, this one. So for this one, we know that there's nothing coming behind that. So that is, well, probably you should also use just the end of file thing there. So that would be kind of the follow symbol for the this S thing. That is kind of the only constant in there. Apart from that, the follow sets are made up from the first sets of other symbols. So, and maybe also follow sets of other symbols. So let's have a look into that. The follow set of a non-terminal B can be obtained by considering all rules in our list of productions, where B actually appears on the right-hand side. That's all the context in which a B can actually appear. And the right context of such a B is all the symbols that you see here. That is the right context of that thing. So these symbols can all yield terminals in the end. We don't know at that point. So what we do is we are interested in the first symbol of that complete sequence that is the right context of such a B. So what we do is we do the same thing as we have done for the epsilon free first sets. We consider the chain of symbols that might be empty, and for all of those we add a superset relation over here to the first sets of the symbols that will connect the first sets of all the x1 to xj in that case with the follow set of B. That is fine. If we take it as given that at some point one of these symbols will actually be non-empty and will kind of terminate this chain of first symbols that are generated by that. If that is not the case, then we end up in the case below. That is this one over here. For the case that all of the right-hand side contexts of such a B are able to not produce any output, in that case, it doesn't suffice to just look at the right context of only B, but instead we have to look recursively into the right contexts of the parent symbol for that particular rule, because well, if the complete rule can just collapse into the empty sequence, we still can't say what the first symbol will look like. So we need to look one step up into the context of the parent symbol, and thus, in that case, we connect the follow set of B to the follow set of A with a superset relation. In general, if you have these kinds of systems, you can kind of quite mechanically try to do your implementation by just going through the constraints on the right-hand side, like that, and just set up for each of the cases in which that is fulfilled, set up a relation of the form of the left-hand side, just without much thinking, just a mechanical kind of test whether that is okay, then add the thing from the left-hand side. It's kind of the same thing as you do for the first sets. So, in the end, you will obtain an inequality system of a quite similar form as we had for the first sets. For those, we know there is this algorithm that sets up a graph that computes the strongly connected components. With that, you can just compute your solution. So it is possible to actually compute these follow one sets from just that definition over here. And with that, we can now actually determine not only for the cases where we have right-hand sides that actually produce something, but also for right-hand sides that might collapse to the empty sequence of tokens, what the appropriate look-ahead should look like. So, for our example, we can now set up the look-ahead table by looking at this thing, which is the first set of a right-hand side of a certain alternative, together, well, one concatenated to the follow set of the left-hand side. So that is what we actually have to consider as the correct look-ahead for an alternative of a production. So in our case, the first set for S, for example, is epsilon and A. Well, let's leave it with that for a moment. And the follow set of S is B and epsilon. That is the things with which we can try to set up the look-ahead table now. So we need to determine the symbols for which we have to choose the S rule 0 and the S rule 1. We do that by setting up these fixed equalities. First, one concatenated with follow. So we do for S rule 0. It's first one of epsilon, which will just collapse into nothing, and one concatenated with follow one of S, which will be B and epsilon. And for the S rule 1, we have the first symbol of ASB, one concatenated with follow set of S. And, well, that will just immediately terminate with A and give us A as the correct look-ahead symbol. And with that, we can now fill in our table. So the entry for A comes from here and will be 1. The entry for B comes from here and will be 0. And this thing is looked up here and is also 0. Okay. Good. So, in the end, we now have a look-ahead table and the transition table for the push-down automaton. And with that, we can now check in case of that problematic situation where we have these items on the stack, we can just look into our remaining input and check whether there's an A in there. In that case, we will choose this alternative over here and choose to go that path and use the second transition. And in case that we find an A in a B in the input, we will see. Okay, we have to choose the first alternative, and this will yield that transition. Nobody bothered by that thing here? Well, that could always match, couldn't it? It's actually a kind of a dirty way of me saying, actually, I would have meant end of file with that. So that's why I was a little bit hesitating for the last few slides to talk about this epsilon thing over here that was already, in here. And so I have to clean up my slides a little bit. So that would have had to be the end of file symbol and not the epsilon, because epsilon would make the complete look-ahead table ridiculously non-deterministic once again. That should have been the end of file symbol. Okay, before we go on, LL1 parsing and setting up transition table, look-ahead table. I hope it's more clear now. Is there still any question about that? Okay. Good. So, let's continue with the topic of left recursion. That is a thing that opens up a discussion about the potential, in the sense of what can you actually express with grammars that comply to LL1, LL2, or for any fixed K, what you can actually express with that. And the thing that we need to talk about in that context is left recursion. What is left recursion? We call a grammar left recursion if there's the possibility to derive from a certain non-terminal A by several steps. Does not need to be several, can also be just one, but in general it's several, a sentence form that once again starts with an A. So that's the recursive aspect of the whole thing. The left recursive aspect means that this A needs to occur on the very left-hand side of the sentence form that we can produce. If that can be achieved, we have the possibility of such a loop where we produce A over and over and over again with that grammar. That is a valid grammar to be formulated in context-free grammars. We also already have an example for that. That was the grammar for arithmetic expressions. Sorry. And that is already left recursive. You can observe that already with the very first production. E goes to E plus T, so that's already left recursive. Fulfills the needs that we formulated in definition. So what is the problem now with that thing? There is a theorem that says that a grammar can... if it is left recursive, then this grammar is not LLK for any K, which means you can never determine a fixed constant for your look-ahead window that the LLK parser is actually able to decide for any input. There is at least one input for which the LLK parser then cannot decide anymore whether the input is compliant to your grammar, or will run into decision problems there, in other words. So, what's the background for that? Well, we can prove that by, well, first of all, have a look at the sequence of derivations that actually leads to these left recursive sentence forms. And, to make things a little bit shorter, I just don't talk about this being a sequence of steps, but just look at the whole thing as one. So, if this A is actually reachable from the start, then this thing can actually occur in derivation trees. So, in order to dive a little bit deeper into the situation, let's just assume that this G is actually LLK compliant, which means that there is a fixed look-ahead window that can decide whether to derive with this left-hand side or the right-hand side or this right-hand side. Then, taken directly from the definition of these LLK grammars, what we need is that the first K symbols of a word that is produced by our grammar, different words produced by our grammar need to have a different first set. In case, needs to be disjoint. In case that they have the same context. Well, to make it a little bit more graphically, what we need to differentiate between is at this situation here, where we have S at some point reaching this chain of of expansions of non-terminal A, which will at some point yield some context gamma that we don't really know about. But since we talk about the same expansion situations, we will just assume that this will be the same right context for both of these yields. We now look deeper into this situation between those two prefixes of the yield, which is either that configuration here, where we expand with A goes to alpha in the first variant, which will then yield alpha, beta, n times, and then gamma, which is that thing, or we have to decide to go for another iteration here, which would mean that we would choose that side here at this position, which would give us another layer of beta subtrees in there, so we would obtain n plus 1 times beta in there, which would be this configuration over here. So that is just to illustrate you that everything is the same, it's just differing in the decision to either choose the first alternative or the second alternative. And the thing with LLK grammars is now that we need to be able to differentiate between those two decisions by just looking at the first K symbols. So you might already see what the actual a problem in there is if we just look at constant number of input symbols from prefix over here. Well, that was not as expected. We just look at a fixed number of symbols over here, by just making this n large enough, we can exceed the look ahead window by just a lot of these beta productions that we have, a lot of these productions that yield betas, and we fill up the buffer with just betas until it runs out, and then we cannot decide anymore between this situation and this situation, and that is what we have to look at here. First, there's once again a corner case that we didn't have on our previous slide. In case that, for example, beta yields the empty sequence, well, in that case, everything's pretty neat because it collapses into first of alpha gamma, and it collapses into first of alpha gamma for the second thing, and both of them are completely identical. So I cannot differentiate between those with a look ahead anymore. So if that would be the case, we already reached a contradiction. If beta is indeed contributing an output that is not empty, we will obtain an output of that form. Whatever alpha is, we get k times this output omega. And we get here k plus 1 times this this output. And with just a look ahead of k, we will just see this fraction of the input. Well, at most, depending on how large the alpha actually is, but we might even see less. And with just that, we cannot differentiate between those things anymore. We get that these things are overlapping, and thus we cannot differentiate between those anymore. So left recursion is a kind of a bad thing for L1 parsing. However, recursion is something that you actually really want to do if you, for example, want something like lists of certain elements of your syntax. So you have several choices to do there. First of all, there is a kind of a transformation for left recursive grammars that removes left recursion from that. I won't go into details for that, because I want to kind of build a bridge into a certain other concept. So what I'm presenting here is another parsing concept that says, well, that is a typical, the recursive thing is a typical problem that you're actually interested in solving, and you can do that, for example, by allowing right-hand sides to not only be just sequences of symbols, but to also have an operator like the Klingi star, like the one that you know from regular expressions. So basically what you do is you allow regular expressions at as right-hand sides for productions. That opens up a new class of grammars, which are the right regular context-free grammars, RR, CFGs, these abbreviations. Okay, they are not so different as you expect from usual context-free grammars. The only thing that that is added is that you get regular expressions of symbols as right-hand sides for productions, and not only just sequences of symbols. Apart from that, they are completely the same. For example, you can reformulate the arithmetic expressions in a way that they are featuring regular expressions of symbols. So, How do you implement that in a parser generator? Well, one idea is to since these clean stars contribute to kind of list productions, we can just use the standard technique of how to implement list productions in LL1 by, well, what's the usual construct? You would do a list by terminator symbol or terminator non-terminal, so that is a list item over here, or a list item, oh no, so many errors today, and the list recursively. So that is the write recursive version of a list that is not problematic. So that would be a standard way of implementing these things. You could even remove that thing and just use epsilon over here if you would be interested in lists that could also collapse to just nothing. So that is the usual way that you implement these lists. And the idea to implement these write regular grammars is now by transforming the grammars in a way that you transform the expressions that you get from clean star into this typical list production. And you can do so in the way that you see over here. So there's a rewrite procedure that generates a grammar G in these special brackets from an ordinary grammar G, and this grammar G in these brackets doesn't have the regular aspects of right-hand sides anymore, but just is an ordinary context-free grammar. And what you would do is you would consider all the productions from the original grammar and transform them into rules of the form that you see over here. For an ordinary rule, you would introduce now a new non-terminal, these special brackets, alpha. And in alpha, you just put the complete right-hand side of the original rule. And then you would work your way through the old rule. In case that anything that you find between those special brackets is just a non-terminal or a terminal, you just simply produce that. In case you find an epsilon, you also just produce that. In case that you encounter a regular expression of the form alpha star, what you do is you apply your actual list production, which looks the way that you have seen me sketching before. You have the terminating epsilon symbol and the recursion case in which you just produce alpha, 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 alpha until you choose the other variant of the production. And the concatenation you just pass through, as well as the variation you also just pass through. So that is the original idea of that rewritten thing. Of course, that is kind of bloaty and will just explode your complete list of productions, but that is kind of the formal way of defining that. In practice, you could quite easily come up with a lot of optimizations in these productions and remove a lot of these steps once again. The most crucial thing is that you would just replace your star things with this special production where you have a right-hand side that alternates between epsilon and the recursive version. And in our case, what that would yield is we would replace, I'm already doing kind of an optimized version here, I would replace the regular expression right-hand side with a new non-terminal like this, which would then produce well, this is a concatenation, so this would go into T, and the new non-terminal that is just the clean star, and that is now needs to be a list production, so this would go into either epsilon or the actual list. Yeah, and all that remains is now that we need something for this one, and that is just the plus T once again. So in that way, you have removed the clean star operation from at least the production for E. And since we still have such a production for T in there, we need to introduce something similar, which will just be the same or quite analogous to the one that we already have done. So that is what you get from this procedure, and this new grammar now doesn't have any regular expressions now, and is just a common LL, well, we don't know whatever K is in there, but this will be an LL1 grammar once again. So for that, there's also a kind of a more formal concept, and RRCFG G is called regular LL1 if the corresponding CFG that has removed all these regular right-hand sides is once again an LL1 grammar. So it's not too spectacular, this result. With that, you can directly just use the table-driven parser that we have introduced for LL1 grammars. However, this might be something that is just introducing a lot of bloaty new symbols on there, which will just kind of lead to a lot of stack growing and shrinking once again, while you kind of try to parse your lists. There's also another idea of realizing these RLL grammars in a more direct way, and that is the recursive descent RLL parsers. They consist in a certain idea of using templates for code in order to implement the grammar in a certain way, and it works like this, as you see here in this idea too. There's a certain infrastructure that you need to set up. For example, what you need is you need to set up a variable that serves as a slot for your look-ahead symbol. In our case, because it's just a very minimalistic implementation over here, we represent tokens with just their class identification, that is just an integer, so the int suffices as buffer for our look-ahead of size 1. And so that is one facility that we need. The other one that we need is this expect function, which is realizing these the look-aheads. So what these do is you can provide it with a set of expected look-ahead symbols, and this just checks whether the look-ahead, which is this next thing, contains such a is contained in the set of expected look-aheads that you give to this expect function. If this thing. Yeah, so let's have a look at that. So if this the concrete look ahead is found in a set of expected things, everything is fine and we return true. If it is not found in there, then the thing yields false and we have some diagnostic output on the console. But that depends on your personal flavor, whether you want to have that or not. So, the general method that spawns a complete parsing is a method that we call the parse method. That is always a fixed thing, and this thing initiates the complete parsing experience by first of all calling the next function with scan, and scan is a thing that the scanner or Lexer provides to the parser. That is a kind of a procedural thing. You just call it for the next symbol in the sequence of input symbols, and you store that in your next thing. And now what you do is you set up the your complete system by kind of misusing the call stack of your programming language as the stack for your item pushdown automaton. See, you need to push things onto the item pushdowns, push additional things on the item pushdowns pushdown as soon as you try to expand a certain non-terminal. So what you do is here you map that to a procedure call. In case that you want to expand the S, is, what you do is you call this S. If you remember, the item pushdown automaton removes things from the pushdown once again if a complete right hand side has been matched with the input. So the method that, methods that are associated with these calls need to somehow make sure that everything that corresponds to its right-hand side is matched with the input before it terminates and kind of remove its own procedure frame once again from the procedure stack. So that is kind of the model that is behind the complete thing. So for our grammar, we start the parsing with this call to this start symbol S. What else is there? Yeah, we need to make sure that the input actually matches with whatever we wanna expand with. So for that, we have introduced this expect function earlier on, and the typical structure that we will see over here is that we will check the thing that we want to expand afterwards beforehand whether that is something that we actually are allowed to apply here. So in our case, since we want to start the complete thing, we want to actually expand the root symbol for the whole thing. But first of all, we need to check whether the input is actually confirming to something that can be expanded from the start symbol. So what we need to do is we need to check whether the first one symbol of the start symbol can be expected in the actual with the actual look ahead. So what we do is we call this expect thing, and in case that the input or the look ahead doesn't match with what we can expect from the first set of the root symbol, we need to terminate our program. In principle, we would need to do something more user-friendly, of course, but that's not what the slides are about. With this facility established, we now go through our grammar and generate a lot of other code from that. Particularly, what we do is we go through the list of productions and look at each of the variants that you find in, well, not variants, each of the non-terminals that we find in there, and for each of them we generate an own method. These consist in remember we've talked about this idea of mapping the concept of putting items on a push down to building up the call stack of a program, and that's why we have to introduce such a procedure for each of those non-terminals, because the stack frame of that procedure will be associated with the item, so to say, in the item pushdown automaton. So, how does this procedure look like? That's what we can't say statically. That is something that depends on the actual right-hand side of the production 4A. In order to actually generate something here, what I do is I define or I kind of decompose how a right-hand side of a production actually looks like. So I take a closer look at how this alpha looks like and match it with several cases over here. In case, for example, that I have primarily a concatenation of symbols over here, what I do is I generate for each of the symbols recursively code. But before I do that, is between each of these generated things, I actually check whether the input really is matching the first symbols that can be expected from the sub symbol sets R1 to RK. And I do that by things pretty similar to the main parsing functions. I just add these if I actually can expect the first symbols of whatever follows over here, then I continue, and if that if I cannot expect the first symbol here in the look ahead, then I need to throw an error and exit my program. With that, I can make sure that the concatenation of my things will actually match the input at some point. In case that one of my sub right-hand side expressions is just the empty symbol, all the code that I will produce is the skip statement, then in case that I encounter a terminal over there, what I will do is I will actually take that away from the input. I will do a consume, which will in the end do something with the input. I don't in that configuration here, it's not said what is actually done with the input. You could interpret what you have read there by your own ideas. The only thing that needs to be done in the consume is that you need to exchange the symbol that you have momentarily in your look-ahead buffer, in this next buffer, with the new look-ahead, because you have actually now read one symbol and you need to renew the look-ahead for that. Apart from that, what you can encounter as right-hand sides is non-terminals, and non-terminals on the right-hand side means that you possibly need to expand and at some point collapse right-hand sides. You do that by actually calling the procedure generated for the non-terminal that you found in there. Thus, you will redirect control flow into another procedure frame. Okay, what else can you find on right-hand sides of productions? There's this clean star, which will just be kind of a repetition of the thing that you find as a sub-expression there. And that can be realized by by a while loop. So this thing will be translated into a while loop that will run as long as the next symbol actually is something that occurs in the epsilon-free first set of R. In these cases, you will continue in the loop body with the code that you associate with the sub-expression R. Then there's, of course, variations. You can have several alternatives for right-hand sides hidden in this thing. So in these cases, you need to actually do some branching, and you need to do that based on the look-ahead. That's the only thing that you can use for deciding what to do next. So what you do for that is you implement that with a switch statement based on the content of the look-ahead buffer, which is this next thing. And you now need to check all the variations of your right-hand side, R1 to RK, for what is the indicator for that alternative. Do that by looking at the first sets of these things, and you see these first sets are now used in context of such a labels thing. Labels will just generate a lot of actual cases for the switch case, and these cases consist in all the symbols from the set, so these alpha 1 and alpha m. So what that will do is that will generate a sequence of labels that can be matched with the switch. With the switch next thing, and in case that any of those matches, the we continue with whatever this R1 will generate and break in the end, and then continue with the next R2 or whatever RI until we reach RK and have exhausted the complete alternatives for the right hand side. Okay, so that is the, I think, all that is needed for that thing. That is a quite popular way of implementing parsers by hand. So if you practice a little bit, you will become quite fluent in translating grammars into this kinds of these kinds of procedures with these structures. Of course, you could also use that in kind of a generator. So you can just give your grammar to this generator and obtain a piece of code that looks like that. And with that, you can then add your personal code in there that you want to execute in order to, for example, assemble then data structures that represent your syntax tree or whatever you want to do with your parsed input. So I don't have a concrete example of such a thing here because, well, you can imagine there's a lot of code that is generated from that, and reading a lot of code in lectures is always a quite straining thing. But there's the tutorial that should give you the opportunity of coming up with your own parser for something, probably regular expressions, and thus, as this would kind of fit into the theme of writing your own engine of regular expressions. So can probably expect something like that. Anyway, that is how I wanted to terminate with a top-down parsing chapter. So this recursive descent approach is a straightforward way of implementing this kind of parsers. We have also seen that not all context-free languages can be parsed in this way. There are grammars that are not parsable with that. As soon as we need as we have conflicts that are not resolvable with lookaheads of size 1, it gets a little bit complicated. There's solutions in practice out there that introduce concepts of rank grammars. Some people favor that. I'm not so completely sure. I consider that these rank grammars are kind of a very coarse way of resolving these conflicts between expansions and of one side and the other, because they always prefer one side. So, I'm not a big fan of that. Also, it's not so clear anymore in terms of expressivity what these things actually can express and how they relate to the other classes. Then there's also the idea of going from LL1 to LLK, and that is a possibility that will help you in larger look-ahead with larger look-ahead windows. However, the thing is that you have to jump through a few hoops in order to get first and follow sets of sizes larger than 1. What we had is a very special case with this first 1 and follow 1. If you want to do first K or follow K, you will have to resort to general constraint solving approaches in order to compute your first and follow sets. And in case of growing K, this will be quite expensive to realize. So in practice, first and follow sets of larger than 3 or 4 will just explode, because you have to combine a lot of possibilities for that. So if you run actual tests on the these kinds of parsing techniques, you will notice that with a K of 1, you won't notice the runtime of the first and follow set computations at all. With 3 starting, you get already a large fraction of your runtime wasted on just computing the first and follow sets, and with even more things, it just gets out of hand. So it's not a popular thing for the people who implement these first and follow sets to increase this K thing, because it comes with more complex code and more runtime overhead. And in general, people just won't bother with implementing more than K1. There's a few out there who do, and they have even implementations for even larger classes. For example, the classes with regular look-ahead. This is this LL star thing that you might find somewhere in practice. These are parsers that don't have a fixed maximum size of a look-ahead window anymore, but instead instead decide the alternatives to use by the means of regular expressions or finite automata, whatever you want to call those things. And they achieve more expressivity with their parsing concepts, because they can They aren't limited by a fixed input size, but can interpret an arbitrary amount of input prefix. However, with that, you also get that you actually have to check for these things, and this might incorporate that you run through your input several times over and over and over again each time that you need to decide which path to take. You need to possibly read the complete rest of your input, which messes up your complexity. So it's a kind of a mixed bag that you get from that. Apart from that, I would like to continue with bottom-up syntax analysis. Is there still any question on top-down syntax analysis? Good. Then, bottom-up analysis it is. Bottom-up analysis is a thing that came up in the books of a certain famous person over here, Donald Knuth. I don't know whether you have read something from him. A lot of people claim to have, but only have his book in the bookshelf. Anyway, his idea in the context of parsing was all this LL parsing things navigate around these the problem that they need to determine very early on in the parsing process which alternative of a production needs to be expanded. That is a thing that Knuth thought was quite a wasteful concept, in the sense that why would I not try to delay the decision with what to expand, so to say, to a point where I can definitely say how to expand, because I've seen all the input that belongs to that bit. That is something that you cannot really do if you look primarily on parsing from a top-down perspective. It's more of a bottom-up perspective, because you look at all the input that belongs to a certain tree at first before you decide how that tree actually looks like. So the key idea is to delay the decision whether to, in this case I wrote reduce, but let's just for a moment think of that as an expansion, until we know whether the input matches the right-hand side of the rule or not. And that leads to the construction of the so-called shift-reduce parser. And the short version of that is the push-down automaton for grammar G for rightmost derivation thing, so this R over here. So what the key idea is here is that all the parser does is it shifts the input successively to its pushdown until it finds that the pushdown contains a complete right-hand side of a rule, and it calls that a handle. And if that is found on top of the pushdown, it is replaced, also called reduced, by the corresponding left-hand side. So that is kind of the inverse operation that we have talked about before. Before, we have talked about expansions, which would take symbols and replace them with the right-hand sides. Now we talk about reductions, that is, right-hand sides being replaced with their left-hand sides. So that is reductions. How does that look like in an example? So we have a small grammar over here that looks like that. And the pushdown automaton for that is or consists of the following things. There are states in there. There's a start state Q0. There's a final state F. We have furthermore, it states the symbols from
the grammar. So it's terminals and non-terminals, because, well, you need to shift symbols from the input on the push down, so we need the terminals. Also, we will at some point start reducing, which will put non-terminals on this on the push down, so we need these things as states. And then there's start state and end state. I've already mentioned this thing. And for our shift reduce parser here, that looks like this. You see, for example, the first transition consists in consuming input and putting that on the pushdown. You also see, for example, this thing over here, which does not modify the input in any way, but it reacts on seeing this AB, which is the right-hand side of a production, on the pushdown, on top of the pushdown, and replacing it with the left-hand side of that thing. So that is a typical reduce action. So you have the shifts, these things, and the reduces in the transitions. Thus, shift and reduce. More formally, construction for that thing. In general, such an automaton looks like the way that we have talked about already. We have states that are just union of terminals, non-terminals, and arbitrary states Q0 and F. The final states is just F. And we have transitions of certain forms. There's the shift transitions. Shift transitions take input symbols, put them on the pushdown. Thus, for any state on of the states on the top of stack or top of pushdown, and terminals from the set of terminals, we consume the terminal and just put it on the pushdown, top of the pushdown. That is shifts. Reduce transitions, how do they look like? Reduce transitions consists in a top of the stack with alpha. If alpha is actually a right hand side of a production, then we create such a reduce transition for it. This consists in those the right-hand side of this production. If that is on the actual pushdown, I don't consume anything, but instead replace the top of stack with now something different, which is this A. I take this A from the production that I have looked at, focused at before. And that's almost all. The only thing that remains is kind of a technical thing. It's the finishing transition that will kind of reduce the root symbol and lead to a final state on the pushdown. Okay. So that is shift reduce parser. And let's have an example computation for our input. We start with the initial state Q0 and input AB. So one of the concepts is shift transition. So what I do for shift transition is I put something from the input on the pushdown. That's what I do here. A is now on the pushdown. That is one computation step of the thing. Next one. A is actually the right-hand side of one of the productions that I had. So what I do is I do a reduce action and put A instead of A. So this one is replaced with its left-hand side. Now I don't have any choice. All I can do is take this input and put it on the push down, leading to this thing over here. Input is now empty. And yeah, still the only thing that I can do here is I can do a reduce action. This will replace this thing here with its left hand side, which would lead to that thing over here. And yeah, now it turns out that this is once again a right hand side of a production, namely of the one for S. And yeah, that's already quite nice, because that is looking a lot like the finishing transitions precondition, and this will lead to the finishing state of the automaton. So that is how the whole thing works. It just shifts the input on the push down, and as soon as it finds something to do on the push down, it will do that. And if it succeeds in creating the root symbol by that, then it accepts. Pretty simple concept so far. So shift reduce parser is something that should be quite easy to see. As a kind of a side remark, what you get there as a sequence of reductions there is something that corresponds to the reverse rightmost derivation for the input. So that was something that we have talked about when we got these derivation things. There's also ways of proving that the whole thing that we did there is correct. In order for that, you need to show these correspondence here. We don't focus on that here, but if you like so, you can do that. The main problem here now is that the shift-reduce pushdown automaton is in general also non-deterministic, once again. Nobody signed up when I did my example computation on there before. But where is the non-determinism actually hiding in there? Well, the thing is that who says that in that situation over here, for example, that I necessarily need to perform the reduce? I could also just do the shift instead and move the B over there. Nobody will keep us from doing so, and if we do so, we will keep this small a on there forever and will never be able to reduce and run into non-accepting state in the end. But of course, the choice that I did here in immediately reducing was a valid one. So there's non-determinism in there. So we need some way of making the shift reduced parser deterministic in the same spirit as we needed a way to make the item pushdown automaton deterministic. And this opens up the chapter of LR parsing. LR parsing covers the concept of how to make the shift reduce parser into a deterministic parser by guiding the shift reduce parser in the question, should I reduce or should I shift? And yeah, that's I think all for today's lecture. LR parsing is the thing that we are gonna focus at next time. So far, thank you for your attention and have fun with the tutorial.